Hello, and welcome to the apocalyptic series finale of Big Mouth, the culmination of 8 dramatic seasons of the most densely plotted and intricate pop culture podcast of modern times. People complained about the nudity in the early episodes, but we toned it down a bit and subsequently won acclaim for our mature adult treatment of universal themes like the latest Fall album or Fleabag. I'm Andrew Harrison, bobbing around in a coracle with a glass of Dornish wine, and Sean Pattinson is a bored hair dragon, ready to burn Soho to ash because they're digging up the streets to put broadband in. Hello, Sean, how are you?
I'm all right, I'm enjoying the dragon.
Enjoying the dragon?
I certainly am. Chasing that dragon. No, I'm not.
Adult content.
I told you.
Absolutely.
Risque.
What's been more upsetting for you this week? The fact that they're closing the borderline or Danny Baker setting his own career on fire in public? What's been worse, do you think?
Borderline hadn't actually been to in years, I must say.
I think there's a lot of it about, isn't there?
Yeah, and Danny Baker just didn't do himself a service. He has subsequently apologised, so maybe it will be all right, but that was all a bit ouch, wasn't it?
It was a bit ouch. I think the last time I went to the borderline, you could still get a pint for about £2.50. So I can't moan, I didn't support the place.
Did they sell tequila there? Was that the problem?
I don't know. But everybody's, oh, it's great, wasn't it? Bingo hand job. That was 1990. That was when, you know, that was when 0171 hadn't even been invented yet.
Yeah, I remember seeing the Verve there.
I had a bingo hand job last week.
Adult content. Sean, who's our first guest this week?
Funny you should ask that. She's a veteran pop writer and academic, an old school Enemy, Select and Spare Rib journo. Spare Rib.
Whoa.
And the author of several pop tomes, including Madonna, Like an Icon, and 3 volumes of She Bop, The Definitive History of Women in Rock, Pop and Soul. Welcome back to Big Mouth, Lucy O'Brien.
Thank you.
As our Madonna correspondent, what do you make of the new tunes and the Latino direction?
I've been listening to them, and I'm actually really enjoying it because it's much more subtle than Rebel Heart. I felt Rebel Heart was a bit of an industry album, but this new one, the tracks that I've heard so far, she's going for a much more nuanced, much more subtle sound, yeah, I actually the track I like best so far is Rise, that she's done with Sway, which is really she's very good at working with new young producers in a way that is completely in sync with where she is at the moment. And I also like the way that she sampled Emma Gonzalez as well,
yeah.
the activist, you know, the anti-gun activist from the Florida high school children. So she's still kind of keeping the political comment in there.
Mm. And is that important?
I'd say so.
Yeah, she needs her edges, doesn't she, Madge?
She does, she really does, yeah.
You also wrote an acclaimed biography of Dusty Springfield.
And which I am updating
as
we speak.
Were you aware of her mother's Pride advert back in the 90s? Oh, back. So again, were you aware of her mother's Pride advert back in the 60s?
I was, yes.
Because we found it and we're going to play it.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Here it is. It's only 30 seconds long. Let's have a listen.
I'm a happy knocker-upper and I'm popular beside because I wake them with a cuppa. Tasty mother's pride. Then they're off in a flash and a rush. It's the bread. And a dash and a push.
It's the bread.
With a flash and a dash and a rush and a push.
Like I said, it's the bread.
It's the mother's pride bread. It makes them love work. They're going berserk to get off to work. It's in the way I wake them by bringing to the side the bread we freshly bake them. Fantastic mother's pride.
What did we make of that? It's cracking, isn't it? I think more pop stars should advertise bread and pretend to be the knocker-upper getting you out of bed in the morning.
I like stars when they advertise normal stuff. I know someone who once advertised Tesco, but she does go to Tesco all the time. And I thought, that's fine then, isn't it?
She also advertised Britvic orange juice.
We need to find out for next week.
You know, a lot of Dusty's tracks, you still hear them everywhere. And she's sort of become so much part of the cultural landscape now, much more than any of the other 60s female artists.
Mm.
And I think it's because she had that amazing versatility. She could cross so many different genres.
Well, I think that was a cut above Jessie J advertising Tuck crackers by a mile.
It's also topical, isn't it? Because Robert De Niro is currently advertising Warburton's bagels.
Robert De Niro's baking.
Robert De Niro's baking, yes.
Talking Italian, possibly to ciabatta.
I think he did it for the dough.
Oh, very good. Oh, nice. Well, there he is. He's joining us today. Also, it's Michael Hogan, TV writer from The Telegraph and The Guardian, former editor of Sky magazine back in those amazing 90s. And this week's Twitter superstar, because he tweeted a list of things that only middle-class people own and the famous people got involved. What happened there? What was on your list of middle-class things that you own?
Oh, God, I can't remember now. I wish I had it in front of me. A list of sort of slightly Bowden, Accardo type possessions.
I just kind of...
I'll tell you why I did it, because one of the papers did a really rubbish one, like things that middle-class people own, included things like hot tubs, which simply isn't true. That's, you know, that's working class swingers.
That's exactly. Nouveau, darling.
So I kind of, you know, I was literally lying on my child's floor trying to get her to sleep one night on Friday night. And I just sort of, you know, typed a list in without thinking about it too much. And then it went a bit viral and people got really angry about it. And it took me by surprise a little bit.
Well, I saw that Goo Pudding has actually tweeted to say that some of their fans have thousands of Goo Pudding ramekins. And probably stage 2 diabetes. Mm. I checked. All I've got is Scrabble, the Ladybird Brexit book, and the old Goo ramekins. So am I a prol?
No, I think there were 16 things. I think 3 out of 16 is respectably lower middle class.
Thank God for that. As a TV writer, what did you make of the penultimate Game of Thrones this week? You can go with light spoilers if you wish, Mike.
I think, Game of Thrones is slightly nosediving, isn't it, towards the end, which is a great shame. And people seem very, very angry about it.
It's funny, we could talk about this a little bit later because it's been preying on my mind, but the idea that it just feels over-compressed.
Yes.
And that characters who used to kind of find their own way and do their own thing and their story would unfold by the nature of who they were are now being shoved from scene to scene. Hurry up, you need to die. Hurry up, you need to fall off a church. Hurry up, you need to be toasted by a
dragon. They should edit those bits out, really, shouldn't they, when you can hear people saying that to them. That sort of ruins
the magic. Absolutely, yeah.
But yes, I think a lot of the problems come from this sort of final season being 7 episodes and you know, apparently they were offered 2 seasons to finish it off. They were offered 10 episodes per season. And the showrunner said, no, they wanted to do it in 7. And I think it's proving a mistake.
It just looks to me like they're trying to satisfy the kind of, on the one hand, the TV must meet my expectations crowd. And also the TV must subvert my expectations crowd.
Yeah,
at difficult. The same time is kind of impossible.
Yeah, and people seem to, you know, I think this is a new phenomenon in TV, actually. I think people seem to think they part own the show now.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, because of the way contemporary culture is and the internet and that. And so people kind of want it to end exactly the way they want it to end. And people are getting furious that the thing they put on their Reddit thread 6 months ago isn't happening on the screen. And that's baffling to me. I mean, you should want to be surprised by television.
Just go down to the charity shop and find a Choose Your Own Adventure book. They are available. This week on the show, we're going to be talking about the unabashedly Scottish rave movie Beats, in which a gang of wee radgers discover the life-changing properties of dancing in a field. Can it bring new light to bear on this universal rite of passage? We're going to be returning to an old Big Mouth classic, The Album I'd Like and Nobody Else Does, in which Lucy and Michael will be bigging up an underappreciated record. Plus, we'll be taking a look at the TV version of What We Do in the Shadows, Taika Waititi and Jermaine from the Concord's cult hit about life in a vampire house share. It starts this Sunday, the 19th of May, on BBC Two. All this and more after these reminders from Sean.
Ravers, Manchester veterans and long raincoat wearers of London and the South East, we have news for you. If you love New Order, and we guess you probably might, then Andrew will be playing a full night of their music at the Connoisseur Audio Bar Spiritland in King's Cross, even, on Thursday, June the 6th. It's part of their Spiritland Legend series, which has explored everything from Kraftwerk to P-Funk to Beatles on a sound system of stupefying quality, and the cocktails, spirits and foods aren't bad neither. Andrew will be playing New Order classics, rarities and the best of their remixes. He will. At least 3 versions of Tutti Frutti are guaranteed. And it's all happening from 8 to 1am at Spiritland, Granary Square, King's Cross, Thursday, 6th of June. Be there and don't forget to dress up like a fish person from the True Faith video. Bring your own trampoline too. Meanwhile, don't forget you can get every edition of Big Mouth a day early if you help us pay our studio bills on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Sign up for the price of a pint, a mere 5 poons, and we'll send you the show as soon as we've manicured the sound to 48-track perfection. You'll get the extra bit too, exclusive to our Patreon backers. This week, Lucy and Michael will be adding to our database of the albums that ought to be on the national curriculum and the ones that ought to be removed from history as if they'd never existed. Search Patreon Big Mouth to find out more. All we're saying is buy us a pint.
OK, let's start with Beats, a new independent movie focusing on the latter days of raving. It's 1994. Urban ravers in their Chevignon jackets are finding unlikely camaraderie with van-dwelling crusties. The criminal justice bill is cracking down on the free party movement, and everything and nothing is possible for the young ravers to be in Beats. Directed by Brian Welsh, his work includes the Black Mirror episode, The Entire History of You. Here's what it sounds like.
The summer's gonna go off. Me and you, right?
The Criminal Justice and Public Order Bill. You heard about this? They're going to make it illegal to have gatherings without music, wholly or predominantly characterised by the emission of a succession of repetitive beats.
See this one?
Hi, mate, hi.
You like it?
It's bouncing, man.
Turn it up.
Everybody is in the place! Everybody is in the place!
Who are you speaking to?
Nobody.
They want to privatise our minds. Keep us in our separate boxes.
Rave to the grave, the biggest night of your life, Scotland.
Yes! Is it a party?
It's a protest. Friday night.
Oi, oi! Can we come with you?
An illegal rave?
Are you mental?
Donald! Please, mate.
Where lawlessness prevails, people become a danger to themselves.
He's a really proper best palser.
I'll see you on the other side then, mate.
The only system I'll ever trust is a sound system. Think about it, yeah, think about it. Beats.
In which straight-headed Jono and his loose cannon mate Spanner experience a life-changing night in a field somewhere in West Lothian. And the soundtrack is the cream of quality rave chosen by Twitch from the Optimo DJ crew. Lucy O'Brien, set this up for us. What's happening here?
Right, well, I'm often slightly worried when we have subculture films, music and subculture films, just because they seem rather studied. My friend Graham Duff, who's written a book called Foreground Music, Life in 15 Gigs, which is coming out in the autumn, he writes about a specials gig that he went to in the late 70s. And he said, if this was a film, then everyone would be in perfect stay-pressed trousers and pork pie hats. Quite often with these music subculture movies, there's much more attention paid to the wardrobe and like getting the vintage clothes and getting it all exactly right, getting the dances exactly right. Now, what I like about this is that it's not a slave to that.
Yeah.
It's not like that film Northern Soul that I felt was a little studied. You really feel like you're there. There's as much attention paid to the character development, the plot. It's a great soundtrack. And it also reminds me of, well, there we were sitting watching the film and I remember you being a designated driver going to some deserted aerodrome in 1991.
Yes, carting six people in a Volkswagen Beetle to a rave.
And it felt very much like that.
We were right back there, weren't we?
So it had that, yes, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
At a plot level, what we've got here is Jono and Spanner are friends who are diverging. You know, Jono, I mean, there's working class families in Scotland. Jono is clearly kind of sort of going places, possibly. You know, his mum's got a new fellow who's a policeman. They're moving to a new house. They're embracing the kind of 90s dream. And Spanner lives in a horrible flat with his appalling monster of a brother, Fido, who's a dealer, and seems to be spiralling downwards. And their paths are going to diverge. And the kind of plot engines are, on the one hand, it's effectively their last chance to have a good time together. And at the same time, the police have clocked that this rave is going to happen and they're going to come and flatten it. And in some respects, it's kind of, you could see that on a post-it note and think, that's the biggest cliche I've ever read in my life. The man's trying to stop the party, kids. And yet they managed to invest it with so much energy and so much truth and so much emotion. It's also shot in black and white, isn't it? Which kind of mythologizes the events. It makes you feel like you're watching. It makes the miserable lives more miserable, and it also makes you feel like you're watching something that is genuinely kind of important. I mean, how did you feel about the kind of the friendship between Jono and Spanner?
Yeah, I think it's really crucial. I think the it's interesting. Afterwards, Brian Welsh was talking about the casting and that they auditioned literally thousands of young people and. And they were almost giving up the process when they found Spanner. And then he just said, oh, well, there's my friend. So it was very organic, the friendship you felt, because it was a genuine friendship.
Yeah, they're real best mates in real life. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. They had great chemistry, I think.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Michael Hogan, what, are you a man with a past in a van? Are you a former orbital raver?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was supremely evocative of those days. It was really good. When they were in the sort of big convoy of cars and Spanner's got a carrier bag full of cans and they're all getting excited. And there's that. I did feel that real tingle of anticipation that we used to feel back then. And it is, I think, the racing is really well done, at least to a certain stage. We'll come on to that in a minute. But the sort of the euphoria and the kind of the bonding and the communal experience, I think, is really well conveyed and quite, you know, the producer introduced the film before we saw a screening of it. And she said that it's a film to see with a group of friends rather than on your own in a room. And I think she's right, because I think it did feel, it was like, you know, I was had a big grin on my face, sat in my seat, and it felt... You felt a bit ravey.
Yeah,
kind of I felt very ravey, actually.
You wanted to kind of punch the air at certain points, and, didn't you? You know?
Yeah, and I think so it would be a shame if you were going to watch it on your own.
Don't watch it on phone
on
the
Netflix
bus.
Or whatever. Yeah, exactly.
No, this is... No,
go with the gang and mates on a Friday night and go out afterwards, I think.
Essentially, what you need to do, if you're listening to Big Mouth, I'm guessing that you're probably not 16 years old, you need to get together your old raving crew and find a cinema with a good sound system, because the soundtrack is incredible. Sean, did you enjoy it? Did it speak to you at a primal level?
I enjoyed it. It didn't speak to me in the fact that I didn't go to frightening raves off the M25. I was a little young when they happened, and then probably a little old when they were continuing. But it was, as you say, it's evocative. What it does really well is give you a sense of being there, and you're there and you're with them. And I think what Lucy says about it's not fetishizing a movement and sort of casting it in aspic. What it's doing is saying there were real people here. They went out, they had loads of fun. It's not heavy-handed about the police presence, although obviously there's the subplot with Jono's stepfather being a policeman. It's more subtle than that. And I thought that it was incredible that it was in black and white. It really lent so
really
much
was,
to
it.
Almost all of it is. And gives it that Bergman boring kind of, what do we do with our lives? And Scotland, you know, is a Northern European country. That bleak, there's nothing to do. We've got a can of cider. What should we do? You know, hanging out in the car park and stuff like that. That's what I think it did incredibly well without anyone resorting into being cartoon characters, because Spanner could have become comedy acid house man, and he didn't. Yes. It was underplayed in that way.
But I think what it did well with the costumes and stuff, as you say, it didn't do that thing where everyone was in perfect costume, because rave wasn't like that. It was a bit more democratic, that you could kind of wear anything.
Yeah.
You know, the price of entry was a hoodie and a Joe Bloggs pair of jeans, whatever, you know. Yeah. And so they do look very different. There's crusties in there. Mm. There's what you'd call Neds in there. You know, there's a lot of sportswear. You know, Spanner's got a terrible haircut that the policeman says is a crime against his heed.
His heed.
Yeah. I mean, my only problem with the film was the last sort of 10 minutes or so. I think it died a bit.
Without spoilerizing it, can you say that in abstract terms?
Yeah, well, first of all, there's a sort of change in its cinematography style towards the end, let's say that. But mainly, it's just the sort of the narrative doesn't end properly for me. The friendship sort of course, they're diverging all along, but it just suddenly comes to a sudden halt. And then there's certain storylines that nothing really happens with them. And then they do that device of doing a kind of catch up caption on the characters at the end, like they did on the recent series of Line of Duty, for example. They always do Line of Duty finales, or like they do the Bake Off final, what happened 6 months later.
And First Dates.
But even that's a bit of a letdown. It genuinely felt like last 15 minutes of the film had been kind of cut off.
Felt that, but particularly the kind of end title thing was a real nice surprise, in the sense that what it doesn't try to do is say, and then the entire world changed and was completely different, because actually it's a small little story happening to a small number of people. Both the police... stepdad strand and the Fido strand, the criminal horrible brother who's a drug dealer strand, end in really quite surprising ways, and ways that make you think very differently about those characters, particularly Fido, which I thought was done with a great lightness of touch and really cleverly. The actor who's playing Fido, by the way, is a fantastic cinema villain. We're talking Begbie grade monster here.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So he's psycho. Worth approaching for that alone. One of the things I really liked about it, though, I think was that the fact that you don't have to really care about rave to enjoy this film, because it is a life stage movie. Everybody's got to a stage in their teenage years when they're going to say goodbye to some of their friends. And you realise that some of you may be going off to do other things, and some of your friends are going to be doing what they're doing for the rest of their lives.
Mm. Yeah, I felt that as well, that it captured that sense of that friendship can be fleeting, but you can share these incredibly intense moments that are quite transformative. And in a way, that's what was nice. It kind of stepped outside the culture, subculture at that point, and said, this is what it does. This is what it does to you. Yeah.
Two things we've got to mention. It's highly political in a kind of you've been up since, you're up at 6 a.m. and somebody's smoking and telling you how the system works way with the character.
It was a little bit on the nose there.
Very on the
nose,
but very funny.
Yeah.
But we've got to mention the girls in the crowd, the girls in the Raven Crew, who are fantastic.
Yeah.
This trio of brilliantly, like massively alive and vibrant, intimidating, crazy girls that who Jono's terrified
definitely of. Not decoration.
They look like they'd stepped straight out of a face fashion shoot to me, like when the face got away from London and high fashion and got into this is what's happening out in the country. These are the girls I admired from afar.
They were like the cool girls from This Is England as well.
Definitely,
swigging buck fast in the... pleased to see Bucky in the back of the car. It's got to make an appearance. Yeah. Not enough people drank water. Only Spanner drank water at that rave,
and I was.
Yeah, but you really need some water under those circumstances.
Yeah.
That was my only gripe.
It was a little bit Children's Film Foundation at the end. It just kind of... It kind of just withered for me slightly and lost a style of my
But that's review. Why I liked it, because it wasn't saying the revolution happened and look, here we all are.
No,
and
no,
is
no,
it
no, that's fine.
It was like the revolution happened
it
and
emotionally
actually
very
it wasn't a revolution.
Either. I even thought the boys were going to cop off at the end.
There is a, they're very tactile. There's
a little moment in there, and I kind of wanted them to, and then they didn't. But then there was then.
They're quite tactile with one another, aren't they?
In a way, that would have been a little obvious and a little heavy-handed. Mm. I quite like the fact that there was that the sense that maybe.
Well, the pills in those days made you really touchy feeling, Everybody did things. It was, small hours in the morning. Who knows? It was a great tune. Everybody's having a great old time.
Right back mountain on E.
Absolutely.
Love you,
I love you too, man. I think, for my money, this is the best movie to come out of The Rave. Mm. I think it is actually better than Human Traffic.
Better than Human Traffic, possibly. It's not better than Train Spotting, which is kind of...
That's only tangentially connected. Yeah. There's a couple of rave scenes, but actually, that's about rages.
I know you like Go. Do you like this American version of Human Traffic?
An American rave film. Come on.
It's good.
Come on, Mikey. Well, the major question that arises is, are we ever going to get a sound system? Yeah. We're never going to get a sound system, are we?
Yeah, we get it.
Yeah,
we
think about it. Sound system. It, yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Now, in a change of pace, we always ask our guests to select a tune for the show. But Sean and I really get the chance, and all that changes this week. Sean, you get to have an editor's recommendation this week. What have you got?
I've brought in Lekali 47 with an old track, Yeah, Money, but it's really good, from 2016. But because she's playing, if you are London-based, next week, 23rd of May, in Somewhere Trendy in Hoxton. Look it up on the internet. She is incredible. She looks like a terrorist. Now, this is the point everyone turns
sounds great.
On. No, she always wears a ski mask or something like that, so you can only see her eyes and her mouth. And she raps. She's tiny. She's from Brooklyn. And she raps in this tiny little girl voice, but about really tough stuff. Also, she's got a concept album about going to a nail salon. That's the basics of the whole of the drama of her last album, Acrylic. She is incredible. She just looks fantastic. And I, for one, am going to be finding out, A, if I can blag into this gig next week, or B, I may even get my money and give it to Mr. Promoter Man.
If she's always wearing a balaclava, I think it's secretly Lorraine Kelly or something under there, and you just don't know. It's a complete secret.
If you look at her, she's not Lorraine.
She's a member of the OCG.
But she looks fantastic, and I think she will be a huge star.
Well, let's have a listen then. This is Lekali 47 with Money.
Laying in the cut though, easy. Tryna see what up though, Brooklyn, home of the cutthroats. Notorious, y'all know how the rest go sleeping. One eye open, too smart cause I'm always scoping. Watching, seeing how these lames look, lazy. This how you get your frame took, money. I got money.
Moving on to What We Do in the Shadows, in which Jemaine Clement and Taika Waititi's Bat on the Wall mockumentary about vampires from 2014 is transmuted to a proper TV sitcom. It features our own Matt Berry as an ill-tempered English vampire, Laszlo Cravensworth, alongside, as he would be, a diverse cast of bloodsuckers from across history and geography. And it's not a cheap spin-off. Waititi and Clement direct most of the episodes. They executive produced it, and special guests include Tilda Swinton, Wesley Snipes, and Dave Bautista. What's it like? It's an awful lot like this.
It's nightfall.
He awakened.
Very cool, Master. Very scary.
Thank you.
Nadja, Laszlo!
Yeah.
Yes?
Can you come downstairs for a second, please?
The problems with living with other vampires are the vampires I have chosen to stay with.
I wanted to talk about general hygiene in the cell. Last night, there were all these people down there, half drunk.
Well, where did they find the alcohol?
No, they were half drunk. They'd been half drunk.
If you've got something to say, then damn well say it.
It's not hygienic!
Nandor is like a big turkey.
Guillermo is my familia.
I'm not a killer. I find people who are easy to kill.
Are you virgins? I don't see how that's relevant.
My name is Colin Robinson.
Hi, Deb.
And I am a energy vampire. We either bore you with a long conversation.
Hey, Don.
Or...
Don.
We enrage you.
I've got my cake caught in the door.
Well, yank it out.
No!
Have you heard so many Draculas in one place? What We Do in the Shadows is starting on BBC Two on Sunday night. Did anyone see the original, Michael?
I must confess I hadn't seen the original.
I saw the original. I thought it was brilliant. Have you seen it?
I've seen a few trailers.
Mm. The original movie is fantastic.
Yes.
Well, I think they expand this enormously and you get... more bang for your vampiric book on this one.
So the original got Taika Waititi the job of directing Thor Ragnarok, which is generally thought to be the best Thor movie. What do we think of this as a sitcom? Can a film then turn into that? Something about Draculas. We've seen this all before, though. But, Michael, how is this new and exciting?
Well, I really liked it. It took me by surprise. I'm often a bit sniffy about the sort of genre things that Andrew Harrison likes. particularly anything to do with the Marvel franchise, which it's, you know, Taika Waititi's loosely associated with now. It's took me by surprise and I really liked it. I mean, partly because of Matt Berry, who I love.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Kay Van Novak, who plays the kind of the self-appointed boss of the vampire house share, was very, very funny. The lady, what's her name?
Nadja.
She was brilliantly mm-hmm. demented.
Vampire.
It's just like a classic kind of flat share sitcom, really, but you know, they happen to be vampires. It's like Father Ted with fangs. it was you know, surprisingly visually interesting. You know, they fly and they swoop and they bare their fangs, and there's like, you know, some effects and stuff, and it's very funny. They're quite cartoonish characters, and it's pretty daft and ridiculous, but rather good.
Does Bloodstained Terror and arguments about Stairmasters and stuff mix well?
Yeah, I think that's the joke. That's the gag, and it's rather good. I mean, I don't know if you remember Being Human, the British show that had Russell Tovey and Aidan Turner in it, and that was about a vampire and a werewolf and a ghost sharing a house, and that had a kind of similar vibe of like the kind of the tedious day to day minutiae of being a supernatural being is quite funny, and they have to board up the house the whole time and not let any light in, and. It was very good at that. The detail was very good and the dialogue's brilliant. You know, Matt Berry does that thing where he just pronounces the one word in 20 really weirdly and it's very funny.
Coast of Transylvania, isn't it?
Sexual intercourse,
he says.
And, you know, it's sort of 25 minutes. Bosh. Yeah. A few laughs. Good.
New elements introduced for TV are Colin, the energy vampire.
He was great.
I love him.
And Guillermo, the vampire fanboy, who goes in search of victims and is always under the cosh, isn't he? Lucy, what did you think of the new characters?
They were actually my two favourite characters. Mm. So Colin Robinson, who's the energy vampire. We all know a Colin Robinson, the person in the office who's just kind of drones on and on. There he is. In the office, and then he's also a Staten Island borough council meeting, just absolutely boring everyone to death.
And he's a daylight vampire, so they all envy him, which I thought was a really nice way of turning it.
Yeah, that was a really creative twist, I think, in the way that he just literally bores people to death and sucks off their energy.
It's funny because it's true, isn't it?
I particularly like the city council meeting one, though, because the measure of what a clever show this is that just in the corners, the vampires are sitting in the back row. because they've been commanded by their lord, the Baron, to conquer the new world of Staten Island. So they go to the city council to basically threaten the city council to come to heel. But Colin's in the corner beaming because it's a smorgasbord of boredom and yes. energy to absorb. Mm. It's like he's like a kid at a sweet
he's
counter,
absolutely
grinning
getting
and
off
vibrating.
On it.
Yeah. But that, he is as fantastic as a character as well because it's a classic, you know, a classic TV sitcom thing of you put together a very small group of people and immediately decide on who's the one on the outside, the one we all can't stand. None of us like Colin, none of us like Colin. Partly because they're a bit jealous of his ability to yes, participate in the modern really world. Like, yeah, yeah, also because yeah. he's phenomenally irritating.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as well, I love the subtext of the work jokes. So that the vampires are moaning because the head vampires are... Well, they, you know, he didn't make it clear that we yes. had to conquer the whole of the yes. new world.
He didn't set achievable goals yeah. for
So they use that language of the yeah. workplace. So
Laszlo like, saying, yes, have you seen yeah. the place? It's fucking enormous.
How are we going
to
do that?
He just wants it, just says stuff, and then you've got to get on with it.
Andrew, you seem to like it. What
I
do you think about
this.
The plot? Because it's a very basic plot, can we say? The plot, Baron is coming. Mainly.
The plot. Mm. Yeah. Well, it's essentially, oh no, my boss is coming around for dinner and I've burnt the chicken.
But mm. Terry and June.
It's, mm. Terry and, yeah. it's Terry and Vlad. It's Vlad and June.
Yes.
It's essentially, it's great. What I think is clever about this is the way it transposes pretty much the most basic sitcom stuff you can imagine into this ludicrous, over-exaggerated fantasy, gothic Bram Stoker world. So the plot, as it is in a regular sitcom, is merely a spindle on which to hang a whole load of great character bits. So, you know, the Baron, and the great thing about the Baron is that, you know, this is not a tatty vampire. This is not somebody with a plastic mask. The effects are really great. He looks yes. genuinely terrifying.
Mm,
so amongst the things it borrows from, Interview with the Vampire is both borrowed from and referenced by Guillermo, who's inspired by...
Yeah, he's like, not a vampire fanboy, isn't he?
I thought it was great that there was a Latino vampire. I thought that was good diversity and representation. So I found that really inspiring. But when the Baron appears, he's not like a plastic crap effect
no,
from 1974.
He's
really, really frightening.
Yeah, so the Aphex Twin about
it's
him,
very,
it?
Very, yeah. very, come to daddy, very, very come to daddy. So you know, you've got the full armed might of a proper high end, you know, TV FX show brought to bear on what is essentially a bunch of sitcom well worn yes. treads, and I really liked that because the audacity and the stupidity of spending such a vast amount of money on such a silly concept, and it essentially being Terry and June. Or, yeah. you know, Steptoe
well,
and Son.
Well, some of my yes, favourite scenes is when they go shopping.
When they went to see
Yes, full gear, you know.
The end or the Redentless down the supermarket.
Yes, buying glitter. And that was my favourite.
Oh, he paid creepy paper and he calls it... creepy paper. No, it's crepe paper. Creepy paper.
I wish for the dust which sparkles. It's called glitter. Yes, like in Twilight. I wish to be like in Twilight for the master when he arrives.
Mm. And then he tries to pay by throwing a kind of ancient coin at the cashier.
But yeah, the other subplot is that Nadja vampirizes a young LARPer, a live action role playing game girl, and the great bit in that little kind of strand is the overblown kind of bodice ripping vampire fiction True Blood language of Nadja. I see that they are cast into the out. They do not know your power as a woman. You do not yes. understand that how your magnificence and beauty. And this LARPer goes like, yeah, like they're kind of mean to me. They just don't let me have.
Beanie Feldstein, isn't she? Who's a great upcoming talent. Who's sister of Jonah Hill, and
oh, really?
She's in Lady Bird, and she plays the lead in the Catelyn Moran film.
Oh, really? Well,
shortly. She's very good, isn't she? She's
great.
Kind of like the anti-bullying trope, isn't
yeah.
she?
Yeah.
She's really...
It's very clever the way they have to find some virgins, so they go straight down to the role-playing.
Yes! Yes!
But I like the fact that she's been brought into the mix, and the kind of the supporting cast, you've got your core vampires, but then all of their familiars are kind of annoying for one reason or another, and it seems to be that, you know, if there's any kind of a message in this massively daft show... It's that even if you are a deathless, immortal, blood-sucking one of the Draculas, you still got to get on with the staff, or you still got to get on with your co-workers.
Yes.
And, you know, it's like, we've got another vampire to deal with. What did you do that for? We don't want any more vampires. Look at her. She plays role-playing games. I thought it was great. I hoovered through several of these episodes,
yes.
and will certainly be hoovering through more of them.
Anyone else? I'm going to stick with this.
Well, Guillermo, I think I just love his character as well, and the fact that he desperately wants to become a vampire.
Yes.
Like maybe today's going to be my day that they'll
I know,
be,
it's a bit like,
a
you know, what's it going to Peggy from ID High wants to be a yellow coat, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, a supernatural version of that.
Very good at very quickly establishing who the characters are, what relation they have with them, and it doesn't matter what the episode is about.
And the constant kind of disjuncture between, you know, in-genre vampire-y things, like them all kind of laughing in unison for a bit too long.
Really manic laughs.
And then a second later, they're on the subway going through Staten Island to go to the council meeting
and things like that.
And great little repeating gags, like such as the fact that whenever they want to turn into a bat, they have to go, bat!
Yeah, Matt Berry particularly has some fun with bat.
But I also think it's really well timed because we are now, God, what is it, 15 years into the modern vampire iteration, you know, the kind of, you know, the sort of, you know, the contemporary sort of self-referential horror thing. And I think it's definitely right now that the kids who grew up with Twilight are now a fair bit older and they're open to mockery of that, and this is very much in tune, I think, with the sense of humour of now, of the young people.
Yeah, deconstructing.
Absolutely, yeah.
Great.
So I'm going to be sticking with it, definitely. Finally on the show, music is a personal thing and there's no accounting for taste. We've all got our secret private preferences that the outside world just doesn't understand, so periodically we ask our guests to suggest albums that only they and nobody else on the planet likes. Not so much a guilty pleasure, because what are they anyway? Why should we be guilty of our pleasures? More of an inexplicable pleasure. Why on earth are you listening to that? Our guests, Michael Hogan and Lucy O'Brien, are going to be telling us theirs after a taster. Get your ears around these two tunes. Major 80s vibe going on this week for some reason. That was Lucy O'Brien's choice, Tina Marie, with Crocodile Tears from the album Naked to the World. Then, who else could it be? Stage struck Michael Hogan with the Kids from Fame album and the track High Fidelity. Lucy, let's start with you. What is Naked to the World all about? And for people who are not sure who Tina Marie is, apart from her appearances in the disco pantheon, who is she? What's she all about?
Yeah, so Tina Marie, she grew up in Santa Monica and a white R&B soul singer. Fantastic voice. She was signed to Motown in the late 70s and collaborated, did some amazing collaborations with Rick James. And then she was really caught in her contract with Motown and had to fight to move from there to Epic. But once she got to Epic Records in the early 80s, she really blossomed as not just a singer, but you know, a songwriter, producer, and she was one of the first female R&B artists to really write and produce full albums. And the thing about Naked to the World, which is the album that I'm choosing today, it came out in 1988. And I remember reviewing it for NME and just thinking, this is incredible. You know, her voice, what she's doing, you're completely locked into this world of a woman struggling to find the meaning, what love means to her. In a really personal, very inventive way. And I wrote this rave review and it just didn't really do much. But then since, I think people have come to really appreciate and understand Tina Marie over time. And I do think there's the fact that she was a white artist in on Motown, people found that difficult to... It was a difficult sell in some ways, and I think that really affected her career.
If Motown had signed The Fall, as they thought about at that time, she might not have been quite a weird fit, because they very nearly did sign The Fall.
Wow, can you imagine?
Well,
the
sticking point was some kind of rather unpleasant lyrics on a Marquis Smith tune. That kind of ended the negotiations.
That would have been brilliant.
It would have been amazing, wouldn't it?
And because he was a big Motown fan.
He was a massive Motown fan, Smithy.
And you're right, I think that would have probably transformed and enabled her to create the music that she did. I'm choosing Crocodile Tears because it's my favourite track on the album. And I love those 80s synths. They're very, in some ways they're dated, but there's something so jagged and so in your face about them, combined with her voice and the way she just riffs and she's going up and down the octaves. And there's this one line that just stands out. Lipstick and perfume saturate your clothing, but it's not mine. And she delivers it in almost one breath. And she just had this great way with lyrics. It's a very sad story because sadly she passed away in 2010 and just in her 50s.
Yeah, it's a strange one because it was the complications from an earlier injury where a picture fell on her head in a hotel room.
Really tragic.
It's very, you know, and very kind of out of the usual for the world of music. You know, this is not, you know, a death foretold us. It's just like a weird accident.
Just a weird, horrible accident. But not wanting to dwell on that because actually she made, you know, an amazing contribution to that whole female soul era. You know, people like Anita Baker, Melissa Morgan, Regina Bell. You know, Tina Marie made her contribution there. She was just amazing.
I listened to this and was struck by how Prince-tastic it was because it's like, it is thwacking drums, massively kind of abrasive keyboards, huge, huge productions. The kind of thing that by the time, you know, by the end of 1988, when suddenly the world has heard Jack Your Body and the idea that records could sound amazing and be small, all that stuff would just vanish, you know, as overnight. I remember one of... reading Walter Frankie Goes to Hollywood, one of the lads in the band complaining, they're like, what have they suddenly decided that records should be badly produced? That's what people want now. They don't want, like, you know, they don't want the big widescreen thing that we do. It does sound really out of time right now, but so out of time maybe that I could imagine this getting chucked on at some do in Dalston.
You know what? I'm convinced that it will find its time, and I'll talk a bit about that later, about, you know, how records can find their time. And that there's just something so, to me, so extraordinary about that album. It's never going to lie down. Yeah. It's just one of those that will come back. You know, it'll find its niche.
Do you push this one on people? Do you send them the Spotify link?
I do. I mean, I even pitched it. I think it was it that Mojo or Q used to have, you know, great albums that nobody loves. I think they had, and I suggested it, but I think even then it was too obscure. So I'm going to keep going with this one.
Okay, well, we'll stick a Spotify link on the Facebook page and the listeners can see what they think about this. Moving on, Michael Hogan, who would have thought that you were a want for the kids from Fame? I mean, I can't picture you pirouetting on top of a yellow taxi cab as the steam pours out of the drains in New York City? Or am I wrong? Is this what you do at your weekends?
Yeah, well, it certainly used to be in 1982. I was a big, big one for the old pirouetting and the leg warmers. this is kind of, you know, I feel slightly shallow for just picking this now next to Lucy's impassioned, well-informed speech in favour of Tina Marie, because, I mean, this is basically a nostalgia thing for me. It came out in 1982, The Kids from Fame, just off the back of the hit TV show. And me and my mum used to watch it together, and we absolutely loved it. It was kind of one of the things that made me obsessed with telly, really. And we went halves on the vinyl copy of the soundtrack album. I think she
forgotten
might have
forgotten Britain.
and I went down to Woolworths and bought it, and went back and we listened to it together. It's, you know, it's a bit shonky and it's a bit like a musical where everyone bursts into song in unlikely places. But every now and again I play it and it just propels me back through time. And High Fidelity, which is the tune I picked to play here, I think is a proper banger. It's a synth pop banger. If Giorgio Moroder produced it, everyone would love it.
Yeah.
And it's got that kind of soaring kind of slightly sad kind of vibe to it. And it's just, yeah, the kids from Fame. What's not to love? They also, I was reminded of them recently, they've just played a reunion concert in Liverpool.
I didn't know this.
Yeah, the last weekend, and it kind of sold out, and that and it could lead to more reunion things. They were all there. Bruno Martelli was there. Coco Hernandez.
I wonder why Liverpool.
Doris Schwartz. I know. I'm a bit baffled by why it was Liverpool.
Big fan audience there.
Well, certainly, I remember it being.
It might be there have been a few things on the One Show about people getting in touch with members of the cast of Kids from Fame, and I think they were from Liverpool, so maybe they set it up. There are some people up there who were trying to get the cast members together, and it snowballed.
Yeah,
so it might be.
But it's a brilliant thing, and I fell down a bit of a YouTube hole this week watching old clips. The Kids from Fame.
Yeah.
And, you know, I loved Bruno Martelli. I don't know if anyone remembers him. He was the kind of he was the kind of musical genius.
He was the Leonard Cohen of the Kids from Fame, wasn't he, really?
And he played like keyboards, and he was a sort of genius kind of keyboard player, but he was from quite a kind of blue collar background, and his dad was a, you know, taxi driver and would always got to
they
save up to buy
troubles.
To buy Bruno a new synthesizer and I know, you're pulling faces, Andrew.
I'm not pulling the face you think I'm pulling.
There was, you know, Doris Schwartz, who was like the kind of the little Jewish princess on the wrong side of the tracks. And then there was Danny Amatulo, who's the kind of rough Italian guy from the Bronx.
Yes.
And Leroy.
Leroy,
who couldn't read or write, but boy, he could dance.
If you were to, you could sell this to me by saying, Andrew, it's basically the X-Men, except with singing and dancing instead of superpowers. Because that's essentially what it is. The X-Men was always basically Kids from Fame, really, before Fame.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you're all from all over the place. Not
but this was 1982 when I was a virgin, and rather than like a 40-year-old virgin man watching the X-Men.
Someone at my school had a copy of this record, and she wore out the grooves because she played it every evening. Because you can. You know, they used to say it was a myth that you could wear out the grooves of a record. Yeah. She didn't have to go and buy another one.
Wow.
Did she go hours with her mum?
I think she probably did.
I'm in love with her. Hook us up.
Do you think part of the appeal for this is that, and the reason why sort of professional rock journalists always turn their nose with this kind of thing, is that it's so direct and there's no irony to it, there's no twist to it. People, as in musicals, people sing what they're feeling without any filter of any kind.
Yeah, it's shamelessly uplifting as well. Yeah. You know, like the songs are called "Life Is a Celebration" is one of the songs, and there's "We've Got the Power" and stuff like that. There's Emmy nominated "I Still Believe in Me," which is a big Broadway ballad, and they are, you know, there is a certain innocence and purity to these songs, absolutely. But at the same time, there's a real sense of fun about them, and if you watch them in context. It's just a load of kids having a great time singing them. And there's a real infectious kind of vibe to it. It's not like, there are shows very much like this on sort of the Disney Channel, Nickelodeon nowadays.
Yeah.
That are a lot slicker and a lot more sassy. And my daughter watches them. And you know, they're basically the Kids from Fame, but kind of with a kind of a sheen of postmodern irony.
Yeah.
Yes.
With a whatevs to it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Whereas,
hashtag selfie,
whereas this is just you know, shamelessly.
It makes me want to
happy.
Go and listen to the album.
It does. Do you think it was in what relationship does this bear to things like the, you know, the X Factor culture that dominated the sort of last, you know, the entire noughties and most of the.
I mean, it certainly bears relation to that sort of thing. I mean, like Fame Academy, if you remember the BBC's version of that, was very much like that. I was also surprised that it was so successful. When I was looking it up this week, it topped the album charts for 12 weeks in the UK. It was the biggest selling album ever released by BBC Records. And
on BBC Records?
Yeah.
Amazing. So it basically funded, you know, Life on Earth with Richard Attenborough.
Yeah, there we are. And the second biggest selling album of the year in 1982, which is extraordinary. I didn't realise it was that big. I thought it was just like me and my mum and Sian's mate.
The surprise to me, listening to it again, was how idealistic it sounds, particularly in contrast to that X Factor way of doing things, where it's all about you've got to beat the one next to you. You've got to be meaner, and you've got to be more driven, and you've got to want it more. And this kind of, in a weird way, even though it was a huge entertainment phenomenon at the time, did feel like a bunch of weird outsiders kind of getting the thing.
Yeah, I mean, the cast weren't particularly pretty. And you know, the Star Maker, I don't know if you remember Star Maker, I found myself welling up. It was when one of the teachers left and they all got together and sang him a song. And he's sitting in this chair, kind of welling up with all the kids around him in a big semicircle, swaying, singing "Star Maker" like that, and it's like so schmaltzy. But you know,
I'd love my students to sing to me like that.
Just drop a hint. You know,
the wonderful thing is about Kids from Fame, they didn't go on to fame. I think the series just stops, doesn't it? We've probably all just got normal jobs.
Yeah, so it could be unheard of again. And the press shots for the reunion gig in Liverpool last weekend were extraordinary because it was just like a load of middle-aged people that none of them look remotely familiar. You have to sort of squint a bit, like Bruno Martelli's lost his hair, you know, and stuff like that. It's just a load of plumbers, basically.
It's going to happen to all of us. So there you go, Kiss and Fame, the album that only Michael Hogan likes.
Fame costs, and right here's where you start paying in sweat.
Absolutely. We're coming to the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over a book fest and a couple of eckies in Hangar 13 while the happy hardcore session kicks in? Lucy, I believe you have thoughts on the music of the past.
Yes, I do. I was very struck by Shakespeare's Sister with their comeback and their tour and everything. And I think I was never that fussed about them when they were first around in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. But now their music kind of makes sense to me. And I was trying to work this out because I was also listening to Nas' Illmatic, which has had its 25th anniversary. And that too feels very much of the time now, really kind of saying something about the time. And thinking about Shakespeare's Sister, I think it's there's something really interesting about that dynamic between Marcella Detroit and Siobhan Fahey and a whole thing about female friendship, so that the songs have this whole added, amplified meaning because of their life experience and the fact that they didn't speak for 25 years. And somehow that adds to the drama of the songs, that we're listening to them in a different way. And there's also, I love the sort of really theatrical side that seems to have come out even more. So it's like we're watching Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. That we got Blanche and Baby Jane almost.
It's French and Saunders, haven't they? They've added an extra layer to it.
But I suppose that leads to my almost philosophical question in a way, and I don't know if I can answer it at this point, is music... why is it that some music, it doesn't really happen at the time, but then later on it really makes sense? Am I alone in this? Or is it like you hear something with new ears? What is it that makes something from the past really of the time?
Well, I suppose it's a question of, you know, you often look back on music that was made when you were a kid or younger through the prism of your own life experience. And that's, you know, a thing that might seem very trivial suddenly seems really important.
Yes.
And vice versa.
Yes.
You know, we've all got things that we used to sort of, you know, go and hole up in your bedroom and listen to it because it's so meaningful now.
Yes.
And then it pops up 30 years later when you've got your iPod on shuffle, because I'm so old I've got an iPod, and you go, yeah, there's not really that much to it, is there? I don't know. I think there's something in the argument that every time you listen to a song, you listen to it differently depending on who you are.
I also have a theory, is that sometimes artists make music and it's subconscious and they don't know what the dynamics are behind the music. And it's only in retrospect when you realise what relationship they had or this was going on that everyone then sees another level to it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that there's a lot of psychodynamics running under that. And suddenly they come out. Magic of time, though.
Yeah. No, and I think that absolutely,
it's
you
amazing,
see that with
though.
Shakespeare's Sister.
Yeah.
But then, you know, in a different kind of way, Illmatic... I remember we were listening to it just a couple of weeks ago, and with my son, and we were driving through South London, you know, going through, God forbid, Croydon, Streatham, Brixton, and it just made complete sense of London somehow. You could transpose all the like reflective lyricism and the mix of the music. It just really fitted the atmosphere of today.
So listeners need to go out and dig out something that they listened to when they were 15. And drive through Streatham or the local equivalents and get the most out of it. Michael, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, I was just going to talk about what it's an amazing week for homegrown television. Everyone's talking about Game of Thrones online. You'd think that was the only TV show in existence at the moment. Mm-hmm. But actually, there are four amazing shows starting this week. There's Russell T. Davies's Years and Years, which started on Tuesdays on BBC One. Which is like a family drama with meets a dystopian vision of the future. It sets up a family. It's really you know, Russell T. Davies got form for time travel since he rebooted Doctor Who brilliantly, of course, 14 years ago. And here he takes a sort of a big rambling family and then just propels them 5 years into the future and then 10 years into the future. And it's really bold and subversive and original, and it's great that it's on BBC One at 9 o'clock in prime time. I think it's the sort of thing that would have been on 10 p.m. on Channel 4 a decade ago. It's a bit clumsy at times, the politics of it, but it's done with real warmth and heart and humanity. It's got a great cast. I would recommend it. And then the following evening, Wednesdays, there's The Virtues, Shea Meadows' new series, which is astonishing. I don't want to say too much about it because it kind of unfolds what it's about gradually, but it stars Stephen Graham as a kind of recovering alcoholic who something happens to him and then he ends up investigating his past and finds things. And Stephen Graham, who's just, you know, fresh out of Line of Duty, in which he was brilliant, is even more brilliant in this. Oh. Like, it's a real career landmark performance for a brilliant actor, I think. And some of Shea Meadows' best work. And then Mum starts as well, which is great. I don't know if you're Mum fans around the table here.
It's
a sort of, you know, quiet little gentle rom-com starring Leslie Manville and Peter Mullen as kind of old people finding love again. And it's the third and final series. It's not going to be one of those sitcoms that goes on forever. It's very much finishing this series, six more episodes. And it is bittersweet and gorgeous. And then on Sunday is Gentleman Jack, which is brilliant as well. It's Sally Wainwright's period drama about the first modern lesbian, as she's been called, Anne Lister, who's this sort of phenomenal Victorian polymath, and with Saran Jones playing her life story. And it's, and again, that it's a really bold, exciting drama to have on at 9 p.m. on BBC One.
So basically you're saying watch more telly, because there's loads of...
I'm saying great. Watch more telly and watch more British telly.
Watch more British telly.
Yeah. Support you're... British telly.
Yeah.
Brexit telly.
Hogan's gone full UKIP. Get rid of your Netflix and your HBO.
Had enough of the American accent.
Let's take back control of our television.
Take back remote control. That's what Hogan is saying. Well, my closing time shot, we touched on it earlier, actually. I'm getting kind of annoyed by vending machine fiction. The idea that you put your money in and what you get out should be the thing, the button you press, the thing you ordered. I haven't really enjoyed it, the ending of Game of Thrones, and I've been trying to put my finger on why. And it's not really because, I mean, I'm sure this is not spoilers by now, certain central characters are turning out to be quite a bad lot. And, you know, certain central characters are not leaving the show in the way you might have wished them to. It's not so much because I'm not having my kind of expectations delivered. It's that it is surprising what's happening to them, but it's illogical.
Yeah.
And I feel that they're being hustled through. But look, the way it's being received out in the endless babble of the internet is, well, you know, they're not giving the fans what they need. We've invested years of ourselves in this and we deserve to get what we want out of it. I don't want a Hearts and Flowers wedding with Jon Snow and Daenerys thingy. I don't want, you know, Queen Cersei to suddenly be, you know, held to account for all of her crimes in front of a jury of her peers and, you know, then executed in some kind of cinematic way. I want something that I don't know I want. I want to be surprised. I want to be amazed. But the reaction to so much, particularly long arc fiction, I'm thinking about Avengers Endgame as well. There's been people complaining about what happened to certain characters there and how that's not just letting that character down, but it's letting down all women. You know, the idea that, you know, somehow, because we've watched all these films, we have a right to what comes out in them. And it all goes back to me. I saw a really, really miserably depressing headline on some fan commentary site a few years ago. And the headline was, Game of Thrones writers are not listening to you, and that's a problem. I would have thought it would be...
There is a terrible sense of entitlement now, isn't there?
Yeah.
And I've noticed that with Riverdale. We really enjoyed the, it at first, but now it's going all over the place. And I think it's because it's responding to the stand.
They call it fan service, don't they? It's a big thing in American TV.
And I'm a fan and of a lot of these shows, and I don't want to be served. I want to be surprised and amazed.
Yes. The bit that's annoying me about it is... well, many things are annoying me about the end of Game of Thrones, but one of them is the way that everyone suddenly thinks they're a showrunner. Yes. Everyone thinks, you know, they're doing it wrong. Yes. And everyone
Well, Dorian Lynskey, friend of the show, he pointed out quite rightly that this idea that, like, you know, script writing conference thought is now kind of out in the world. Do you know the idea? Mm. Everybody, as you say, everybody thinks that they've been doing screenwriting 101. Mm. And they talk in terms of acts and sticking
the
landing. And you know, has this thing been earned?
Yeah.
I don't want to think about that. I want to think about TV drama as the Pompidou Centre with all the bits on the outside so I can see how they're working. I want to be surprised and amazed and dumbfounded by it.
And let people who are good at what they're doing do it. It's just
part of the infantilization of culture, really. Everyone is just basically massive babies who want what they want, and they want it now. And I mean, with the Marvel thing, Endgame worked well, right? They landed that ending.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones isn't landing the ending.
Well, we haven't seen the last one yet, but it's certainly not looking that way, is it? It's looking like it. And not in the sense that we've been given a whole lot of stuff that we didn't want, but in the sense that suddenly this thing that used to develop at its own pace because of the way the characters had been created, and actually the story that extended itself, because every time George Martin created a new character, he has to let them play out because that's the kind of writer he is. Suddenly it's in the hands of other people who are like, well, no, we need this person to die in this episode. No, we need to have an enormous battle in this episode, so a whole lot of stuff's going to need to happen. Again, without too many spoilers, a couple of key antagonists... It actually happens twice in the penultimate episode of Game of Thrones. Two key antagonists have utterly meaningless battles and die, both of them. So four great characters are taken off the board.
People are changing personality entirely as well, aren't they?
Yes.
I mean, people like Tyrion and stuff. And isn't the problem really that they ran out of books a couple of series ago and the last two series are turning out to be pretty duff because Benioff and Weiss, for all their many plus points, aren't as good a writer as George R. Martin? And that's essentially the problem. But now the whole world's toys are coming out of the pram about it.
I think it's more than that they ran out of story. I think that it is, there's a massive change of, or a disconnect of, pardon me, what story is between George Martin and Benioff and Weiss. George Martin is about just, I think somebody described it as planters. He's a planter. He plants seeds and he lets them grow, and it might take a very long time. So he may need to turn around to his publishers and say, actually, I need to write three more books here to get all this polished off. And the opposite of a planter is a plotter. I plotted it all out. These are the beats that need to be hit. This is what needs to happen. X needs to die here. X needs to die there. Oh, I only need seven episodes.
You need someone who can hold their nerve. I mean, it strikes me Michael Hirst is a fantastic writer for that. You know, like we've been watching Vikings and that, you know, there are seeds planted like way back that you think, oh, Christ, that's so interesting. Mm-hmm. But it's taken like several seasons for it to... for you to realise.
Yeah. I can't imagine Benioff and Weiss being able to create a Hodor moment at all. Sean, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, as you know, one of my sidelines is drawing and illustrating, and this is the time of year when it's Eurovision.
Oh, yes.
And the sixth year running, I'm doing Eurovision live draw, which means I draw all the Eurovision entries as they happen on the telly. Put it out on the Twitter. We used to do a system where people would pay for one, and now we do a proper fundraising Just Giving page. So I just wanted to give the Just Giving page out. It's justgiving.com/fundraising/SeanSuperman, all one word. I will be tweeting that out, and Big Mouth, I might make them on the Twitter put a little link.
Yep, sure.
It all goes to Great Ormond Street Charity. Last year we raised £431.
Yay!
It all went, and that was double of what I thought we might get. This year, hopefully, we could get a bit more. It's really good fun. Have a drink. Watch Eurovision, controversially enough. Madge might be on as well, which is quite exciting.
Yes, she is.
Yeah. Whoa, so we're going to do that.
And
hopefully,
Madge.
Yeah, I'm going to draw 28 or more paintings, and they each go out to everyone. I pay for the postage and materials, and they go out, and you win one if you're part of this lucky dip.
Fantastic. Do the URL again. What is it?
The URL is justgiving.com/fundraising/SeanSuperman.
Amazing. Well, that's a fantastic way to end the show. Thank you to Lucy O'Brien and Michael Hogan for coming in. And you're going to be sticking around for the extra bit in a minute, aren't you?
Yeah.
For the Patreon people. Sean, thank you for co-presenting Tom Bullen of Edel Studios in London. Thank you for saving our bacon this week and recording us. We really do appreciate it. We're going to play out with my choice of track. And hey, it's a rare St. Etienne 7-inch. What a surprise. This track, Saturday Boy, was released for Record Store Day, but they've cheated and they made it available on download too. It's about football, which is very dear to my heart at the moment. It nearly made it onto their home counties album, and it's very, very good. Here it is, and we'll see you next time. Until next week, don't feed the dragons. I saw him there under the moonlight. I tried to catch his eye. I saw him there under the floodlights. I think I'm gonna try. There's a fixture on Friday.